Neville Shute's On the Beach has earned its place among the most powerful anti-war novels ever written. Published in 1957 during the height of Cold War tensions, this haunting tale became an immediate cultural touchstone that influenced generations of peace activists and nuclear policy discussions. The 1959 film adaptation starring Gregory Peck and Ava Gardner further cemented its legacy, with both the book and film reportedly moving President Eisenhower to tears. Einstein himself called it the most important novel of our age, while Carl Sagan cited it as a formative influence on his nuclear winter theories. What makes this work so enduring is not just its apocalyptic premise, but its unflinching examination of how ordinary people face the ultimate end with dignity, denial, and quiet courage. The story opens in a post-nuclear war world where radioactive fallout has already decimated the Northern Hemisphere's population. Only Australia and scattered regions of the southern continents remain habitable, for now. The novel centers on a small group of characters in Melbourne, each grappling with the knowledge of their impending doom in distinct ways. American submarine commander Dwight Towers maintains his naval discipline and dedication to duty despite having lost his wife and children in Connecticut. Young Australian naval liaison officer Peter Holmes struggles to balance his professional responsibilities with protecting his wife Mary and their infant daughter Jennifer from the harsh reality of their situation. The vibrant and complex Moira Davidson, who develops deep feelings for Dwight, masks her fear with alcohol and forced gaiety. Scientist John Osborne approaches their fate with cynical pragmatism, choosing to spend his final months racing his Ferrari and pursuing material pleasures. What makes the premise so chilling is its meticulous scientific plausibility. The radioactive cloud moves inexorably southward, following established global wind patterns, a meteorological reality that gives the novel its terrible tension. The characters can track its progress through radio reports of cities falling silent, one by one, as the contamination spreads. There's no dramatic escape possible, no last-minute salvation, just the quiet certainty of extinction within months. The characters know precisely when they will die, down to the week, creating an existential scenario that forces each to confront what matters most when all future is eliminated. Some, like Mary, retreat into denial, while others, like Osborne, embrace hedonism or, like Dwight, cling to routine and duty. The novel's power comes from its deliberate restraint and attention to ordinary details. There are no scenes of the war itself, no dramatic explosions or heroic last stands. Instead, we see only the aftermath through the eyes of those who weren't directly involved but must bear the consequences nonetheless. Daily life continues with an eerie normalcy. Gardens are still planted, though they'll never see harvest. People maintain their jobs and social obligations. Children's birthday presents are bought for celebrations that will never come. This focus on the mundane aspects of life in the face of extinction underscores Shute's message. In nuclear war, there are no winners, no safe havens, and ultimately, no survivors. The government's distribution of suicide pills becomes merely another bureaucratic procedure, highlighting the banality with which the end of human civilization approaches. What would you do if you knew precisely when the world would end? Shute's characters respond in ways that feel achingly human, demonstrating the complex psychological mechanisms people employ when confronting inevitable doom. Their responses range from steadfast denial to desperate attempts at normalcy, each coping strategy revealing profound truths about human nature. Mary Holmes exemplifies the power of routine and future-oriented thinking as defense mechanisms. She meticulously plants gardens she'll never see bloom, selecting perennials that won't flower until months after radiation reaches Melbourne. She discusses paint colors for rooms that will never need refreshing and plans extensive home improvements for next year. These actions serve as both denial and affirmation, a way to maintain sanity by clinging to the familiar rhythms of domestic life. Dwight Towers' denial manifests in an even more heartbreaking manner. he steadfastly speaks of his wife and children in the present tense, maintaining elaborate fiction about their lives in Connecticut. His shopping expeditions become particularly poignant, spending hours searching for a specific pogo stick his daughter wants, carefully selecting a fishing rod for his son's upcoming birthday. These aren't merely acts of denial. They're rituals of remembrance and love, allowing him to maintain his identity as husband and father even after losing everything. When Peter brings home government-issued suicide pills, the scene crystallizes the horror of their situation. Mary's violent rejection, "Are you trying to tell me what I've got to do to kill Jennifer?" captures a mother's primal resistance to harm her child, even when that harm might be mercy. The devastating conversation that follows, where Peter forces Mary to imagine their baby daughter dying alone and in pain, represents the novel's emotional nadir. Mary's flight from the room, hands pressed against her ears, embodies the visceral human reaction to unbearable truth. Moira Davidson's evolution shows another face of denial transforming into acceptance. Initially, she drowns her fears in alcohol and casual flirtation, seeking oblivion in temporary pleasures. Her transition to pursuing secretarial studies demonstrates both denial, "I'll be able to get a good job next year," and a profound human need for purpose and growth, even in life's final moments. This phenomenon spreads through Melbourne as university enrollments surge, reflecting a collective desire to find meaning in education and self-improvement even as time grows short. John Osborne's observation that none of us really believe it's ever going to happen, not to us, encapsulates a fundamental truth about human psychology. This cognitive dissonance, simultaneously knowing and not knowing, enables survival in the face of certain death. The characters maintain this delicate balance, planning futures they'll never have while carrying the weight of their approaching end. It's a universal human tendency that Shute captures with devastating precision, showing how people can acknowledge mortality intellectually while emotionally holding it at arm's length. The relationship between Commander Dwight Towers and Moira Davidson forms the emotional core of the novel. Their connection develops gradually, beginning with a sailing mishap where Moira's bathing suit top comes undone, creating an awkward moment of vulnerability. Later, as they sit in the garden's darkness, their conversation turns to the inevitable spread of radiation, with Moira breaking down in tears over all she'll never experience, seeing Paris, having a family. What makes their relationship so moving is its impossibility. Dwight remains psychologically committed to his dead wife Sharon, speaking of her in the present tense and keeping her photograph in his cabin. When Moira notices his damaged socks and missing shirt button, she offers to mend them, creating a domestic intimacy that both comforts and pains them. Their relationship exists in a liminal space, not quite romance, not merely friendship, but something uniquely suited to their extraordinary circumstances. When Moira gives Dwight the pogo stick with Helen Towers painted on it for his daughter, it represents her acceptance of his psychological reality. Rather than demanding he acknowledge his family's death, she helps him maintain the fiction that sustains him. "Sharon wouldn't mind me doing this," Dwight says as he kisses Moira. "It's from us both." This tender moment acknowledges the complex emotional reality they inhabit, a space where past, present, and the future that will never coexist. Their final parting is understated yet devastating. Dwight maintains naval discipline to the end, refusing to let Moira join him on Scorpion's final voyage. She drives to Barwon Heads to be near him when he goes home, taking her suicide pills as she watches his submarine disappear into the mist. Her final prayer and hope that Dwight would wait for her suggests a belief in reunion beyond death, perhaps the only happy ending possible in their circumstances. The novel's middle section chronicles USS Scorpion's grueling 31-day mission to investigate mysterious radio signals emanating from Seattle. This journey serves multiple narrative purposes, weaving together scientific investigation, psychological drama, and a devastating tour of nuclear devastation. The mission tests both the controversial Jorgensen effect theory, which suggests radiation levels might be decreasing faster than expected, and the crew's emotional resilience as they confront the stark reality of global annihilation. The submarine's northward journey provides a methodical catalog of destruction along the Pacific coast. San Francisco's iconic Golden Gate Bridge has partially collapsed, its red steel frame twisted and broken, while the surrounding Marina District and Richmond neighborhoods show extensive fire and blast damage. Radiation readings in the Bay Area remain lethal, with levels far exceeding human survival thresholds. Further north, the Columbia River region reveals apocalyptic devastation. A massive burn zone, approximately 7 miles long and 5 miles wide, created by an airburst missile that had transformed the landscape into a lifeless wasteland. Seattle's skyline appears deceptively intact, protected by its sophisticated missile defense systems that prevented direct hits. The Space Needle still stands as a haunting monument to human achievement, but the city is enveloped in deadly radiation. The crew's instruments record levels that would kill unprotected humans within hours, making any hope of survival impossible despite the preserved infrastructure. The source of the radio signals, the mission's primary objective, delivers the crew's most crushing disappointment. Rather than finding survivors, they discover a fallen window frame in an office building resting against a transmitting key and sending random electrical impulses into the ether. This mundane explanation destroys their last vestige of hope for finding human life in the Northern Hemisphere. The psychological impact on the crew proves devastating. During their month underwater, they experience not only physical deterioration, emerging weak and pale from the extended submersion, but profound emotional trauma. Several crew members develop severe depression, while others struggle with insomnia and anxiety. The ship's doctor reports a sharp increase in requests for sleeping medication and psychological consultations. Commander Towers maintains his professional demeanor, but privately acknowledges to his executive officer that the mission has confirmed their worst fears. The Northern Hemisphere is truly dead, and the radiation's inevitable spread means humanity's extinction is only a matter of time. The mission serves as a turning point in the narrative, transforming abstract concepts of nuclear devastation into visceral, personal experiences that forever alter the crew's perspective on their remaining time. Their return to Melbourne carries not just scientific data, but the weight of absolute certainty about humanity's fate. As radiation approaches Melbourne, society undergoes a strange dissolution that Shoot portrays with remarkable subtlety. Rather than depicting chaos or violence, he shows a gradual abandonment of social structures as they lose meaning. Bank managers stop recording transactions, shops leave their doors unlocked at night, and workers drift away from their posts without formal resignations. Few people continue working regularly, and those who do seem motivated more by habit than necessity. Shops stop caring about payment, wages become meaningless, and the concept of debt evaporates. After all, who will collect? Cars reappear on roads as hidden petrol reserves emerge. What's the point of saving fuel when there's no future? Luxury vehicles previously kept in private garages now cruise the streets, driven by people who never owned them but always dreamed of taking the wheel. The roads fill with borrowed cars as social conventions around ownership dissolve. Yet remarkably, there's an unspoken understanding. Take what you need, but don't take everything. This period has a dreamlike quality as people pursue their final pleasures with both urgency and strange casualness. Skiers flock to the mountains one last time, ignoring the usual seasonal closures. Peter and Mary work meticulously on their garden, planting flowers that will bloom long after they're gone, a poignant act of hope or denial. Weekend sailors take their boats out daily, restaurants serve their finest wines without checking prices, and children skip school with their parents' blessing to spend time at the beach. The Australian Grand Prix becomes a powerful symbol of this end times mentality when it's moved forward to August 17th. The race attracts nearly 200 entries, triple the usual number. from drivers determined to race regardless of risk. The qualifying races prove deadly as drivers compete with reckless abandon, taking corners at impossible speeds and attempting passes that would normally be suicidal. Several fatal crashes occur, but the races continue. These deaths seem almost irrelevant in the shadow of the approaching radiation. Melbourne itself begins to decay. Streets go uncleaned, businesses close their doors without announcement, and basic infrastructure maintenance ceases. Leaves pile up in gutters, windows remain unwashed, and grass grows wild in public parks. This physical deterioration parallels society's breakdown, yet remarkably, there's little violence or panic. Instead, people face the end with a quiet dignity that feels authentically Australian in its understated stoicism. The novel's most disturbing aspect may be how normal everything appears on the surface. People still attend church services, though sermons increasingly focus on acceptance rather than salvation. They host dinner parties where conversations carefully dodge the future tense. Fishing enthusiasts still debate the best spots and techniques, maintaining the pretense of continuity. This juxtaposition of ordinary activities against extraordinary circumstances creates a cognitive dissonance that heightens the tragedy. When Dwight insists on waiting for the official opening of trout season, despite knowing he'll be dead before it arrives, the absurdity of maintaining such rules in the face of extinction becomes painfully clear. Yet his adherence to these conventions represents a final, desperate attempt to preserve humanity's civilizing structures until the very end. On the Beach raises profound ethical questions about how we face death, both individually and collectively. The government-issued suicide pills represent perhaps the most controversial aspect of the novel, forcing readers to grapple with fundamental questions about human agency and dignity in the face of inevitable doom. Is it more humane to end life quickly before radiation sickness causes suffering? Who has the right to make this decision for others, particularly for children like Jennifer? The government's distribution of these pills suggests a tacit acknowledgement that swift death might be preferable to prolonged suffering. Yet this pragmatic solution carries devastating moral implications. The scene where Peter explains to Mary how to euthanize their baby Jennifer stands as one of literature's most haunting moments of parental anguish. Peter argues that if Jennifer outlives Mary, she would be left alone, crying and vomiting all over herself in her cot, with no one to help. This scenario forces readers to confront an impossible choice between protecting a child from suffering and taking their life, a decision that challenges our most basic understanding of parental duty and love. The scene resonates particularly because it transforms the abstract concept of mass extinction into an intensely personal moral crisis. The novel extends its ethical inquiry beyond human relationships to explore our responsibility to animals and the natural world. Mr. Davidson's genuine concern about his cattle potentially outliving humans with no one to feed them hay reveals the complexity of human stewardship. His worry transcends mere practicality, touching on deeper questions about humanity's obligations to the creatures under our care. This quiet moment expands into larger questions about environmental ethics and our species' role as Earth's caretakers, even as we face our own extinction. Perhaps most striking is how the characters maintain their moral codes even when they've lost all practical purpose. Dwight's refusal to fish before the season officially opens, stating he won't break the regulations of a foreign country, might seem absurd given the circumstances. Similarly, John Osborne's strict adherence to racing protocols in the face of imminent death appears almost comically rigid. Yet these seemingly irrational adherences to rules reveal a deeper truth, that our humanity lies partly in the social contracts and moral frameworks we construct. These characters understand, perhaps instinctively, that abandoning these principles means losing something essential about themselves. The novel suggests that maintaining ethical behavior in the face of extinction isn't merely about following rules, it's about preserving human dignity and identity until the very end. Through these various moral dilemmas, from the personal to the societal, On the Beach explores how our choices in facing death reveal fundamental truths about what it means to be human. The character's struggles with these ethical questions demonstrate that even in humanity's final chapter, the way we choose to end our story matters profoundly. The novel's closing chapters are remarkable for their measured restraint and quiet power. As radiation sickness inexorably reaches Melbourne, characters face their end not with melodrama or despair, but with a profound dignity that speaks to the resilience of the human spirit. The symptoms begin appearing, nausea, weakness, dizziness, yet the characters maintain their composure and daily routines until the very end. Peter Holmes approaches death with the same meticulous attention to detail that characterized his naval service. He carefully prepares their home for their final moments, ensuring every comfort for his family, filling hot water bottles, arranging their bedroom, and methodically following the instructions on the government-issued red pill cartons. The scene between Peter, Mary, and their infant daughter Jennifer is devastating in its simplicity. They hold each other close, express their love without dramatic speeches, and take their tablets together. The family's final tableau captures both the intimacy of their bond and the universal human desire to face death surrounded by loved ones. Dwight Towers exemplifies the naval officer's code until the last moment. His decision to deny Moira's request to join Scorpion's final voyage isn't merely about regulations. It represents his unwavering commitment to duty and honor. The submarine's final mission becomes a powerful symbol. Dwight leads his crew in precise military protocol as they systematically flood the ballast tanks and ensure Scorpion will rest permanently on the ocean floor. This painstaking attention to proper naval procedure might seem futile with humanity's extinction imminent, yet it represents something profound about human dignity. That maintaining our principles and performing our duties with excellence matters, even when no witnesses will remain to record these final acts. Moira Davidson's transformation reaches its poignant conclusion in her final hours. Her journey from a hard-drinking party girl to someone capable of facing death with grace and purpose is perhaps the novel's most moving character arc. Her decision to drive to Barwon Heads isn't an act of desperation, but a conscious choice to be as close as possible to Dwight when the end comes. The scene of her parking her Ferrari overlooking the ocean, watching Scorpion disappear beneath the waves, carries tremendous emotional weight. Her quiet prayer and the deliberate way she takes her tablets with Brandy, her constant companion throughout the story, shows how she's transformed her relationship with alcohol from an escape to a final ritual. Her whispered hope that Dwight will wait for her suggests not just romantic love, but a deeper spiritual belief in continuation beyond death, perhaps the only meaningful comfort possible in the face of such absolute finality. The novel's ending achieves its power through what it doesn't say as much as what it does. There are no grand speeches, no hysteria, no last-minute revelations, just ordinary people facing extraordinary circumstances with quiet courage and dignity, maintaining their humanity until the very end. On the Beach derives its title from T.S. Eliot's poem The Hollow Men, which ends with the famous lines, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper." This reference perfectly captures the novel's quiet apocalypse. There are no dramatic last stands or heroic sacrifices, just ordinary people facing extinction with whatever grace they can muster. The novel's power comes from its plausibility. Unlike many post-apocalyptic stories that offer hope through survivors or rebuilding, Shoot presents extinction as the inevitable conclusion to nuclear war. This uncompromising vision serves as a warning that remains relevant decades after publication. When Peter and Mary discuss how the war began with Albania before spreading between major powers, we're reminded how easily small conflicts can escalate when nuclear weapons enter the equation. What makes On the Beach truly haunting is not just its depiction of humanity's end, but its insight into how we face that end. Through characters like Dwight, Moira, Peter, and Mary, we see reflections of ourselves, our capacity for denial, our need for purpose, our desire for connection, and ultimately our ability to face the unthinkable with dignity. In an age when nuclear proliferation continues and climate change threatens global stability, Shute's warning resonates with renewed urgency. Perhaps the novel's greatest achievement is making us care deeply about characters we know are doomed from the first page, reminding us that every human life has value and that how we live matters, even in the shadow of extinction. As we close the book, we're left with both a profound sadness and a renewed determination that such an end must never come to pass.